This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, the Atlantic's Graham Wood joins us, along with a local Islamic scholar, to discuss some of the latest news surrounding the so-called Islamic State. We'll talk about Boko Haram's recent pledge of allegiance to ISIS, along with U.S. efforts to end Islamic extremism in the region. But first, following Tuesday's election, Benjamin Netanyahu will now serve a fourth term as Israel's prime minister. Today, our Middle East expert Jeremy Pressman joins us to weigh in on the election, what it means for the future of Israel's relations with the U.S., Palestine, and beyond. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Jeremy Pressman is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Connecticut. Welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me, John.
And I should tell our listeners that you'll be moderating a panel discussion called The Future of Israeli-Palestinian Relations on Thursday, March 26th at 7 p.m. It's at UConn's Thomas J. Dodd Center. We've got more information on our website, WNPR.org, and we'll be talking more specifically about what is going to be in that talk later in our conversation. First, to the re-election of Benjamin Netanyahu, it seemed for a while that he might actually not pull out this victory, that his challengers had some momentum. Are you surprised at all in the outcome of this Israeli election?
I think there's surprise in terms of the actual numbers. Just the last polling in Israel did not suggest that Netanyahu had to have the kind of edge that he did coming out of it. So I think that he was very successful in the last few days of the election, as some have suggested, cannibalizing the other right-wing parties. He pushed hard to the right. He made some very clear pro-right-wing arguments, and he won voters over from some of the smaller right-wing parties to really push Likud out in front. And I think what made it especially surprising was not only did he do better than the last polling before the election, but he did better than even the exit polling on the day of the election. And so the kind of expectations, the sort of lower expectations, and then to have a resounding victory, I think it even magnifies Netanyahu's success here.
Was it really about some of the very strong rhetoric that he used in the final days of the campaign, whether or not it was talking about a Palestinian state even being a possibility, or talking about Arab voters coming out in droves to the polls? Was it that sort of language that helped lead him to victory?
I think absolutely. And that language reflects that under the surface, what Netanyahu and Likud was saying was, you have to come home to Likud. You have to support Likud. Otherwise, you're risking that the president of Israel will choose the left-wing parties to make, or center-left parties to make the next government. So you really, this is a huge election, and it's time to come home to the Likud.
We're going to talk quite a bit about Israel and Palestine and hear a little bit from the interview that Steve Inskeep did with Benjamin Netanyahu in just a moment. That was on this morning's Morning Edition. But very quickly, I want to turn to the impact on the negotiations that the U.S. is having with Iran over its nuclear program. Of course, with much fanfare, Benjamin Netanyahu, while in the middle of this election campaign for him, was invited by members of the U.S. Congress, Republicans, to speak in front of Congress and the American people. And he soundly said that the United States should not be entering into nuclear negotiations with Iran. I guess I'm wondering first what impact that storyline had on Netanyahu's election, and then what impact you think that some of his actions have had on U.S. Relations right now with Iran.
I don't think that storyline hurt him. Standing in front of the U.S. Congress to wild applause, always it's a nice optic, but I don't think that was the major storyline. I think the major storyline was going to Israelis and saying, if you want to be secure going forward, you have to vote for Likud. If you want to risk your security, vote for some other party. So I think the basic security issues of Palestinians, Hamas rockets, those kind of issues were really what drove the election. Again, it didn't hurt to come before the U.S. Congress, but in these last few days, that's not what caused the surge. In terms of the U.S. or really P5 plus one negotiations with Iran going forward, I think what we're looking at is not a change in the Obama administration. I think, if anything, this is going to deepen the Obama administration's desire to continue on the tack that they've been going. Where I think you could have some influence, potentially, let's see if there's an agreement, is in the U.S. Congress. Because in the same way that seeing Netanyahu likely be the next prime minister of Israel causes certain reactions among the Obama officials, I think it also, as we've seen, causes a certain excitement among the GOP leadership of Congress. And so there may be more confrontation if there is a deal and if there are certain stipulations or requirements that have to go through Congress.
Could you parse out for us, in your mind, how you see Israel and the reaction to these two threats that they talk about constantly? One is the threat of rockets from Hamas coming from Gaza, the day-to-day violence that allows Benjamin Netanyahu to talk about security on the ground for Israelis day to day. Then the more existential crisis surrounding Iran, how they feel Iran with a nuclear weapon could obliterate Israel. Are these part of the same conversation between the Israeli government and the Israeli people? Or are they two very, very different things?
I think they're different in the sense of how different political leaders use those two arguments. I think there's unanimity among the mainstream left, mainstream center, and mainstream right in Israel that Iran is a threat and something has to be done about it. There's differences about what role the United States should play, how Israel should convey its differences to the United States. But at the end of the day, I think those are tactical differences. On the Palestinian question, I think the differences are fundamental. If you go from the mainstream left to the mainstream right, you are looking at fundamentally different ways of addressing the Palestinian question, fundamentally different perspectives on whether a two-state solution is the endpoint and whether it would result in Israeli security or a disaster for Israel. So I think the differences are just much deeper on the Palestinian question.
We're talking with Jeremy Pressman, who's an associate professor of political science and director of Middle East Studies at the University of Connecticut. He's going to be continuing this conversation as part of a panel discussion called The Future of Israeli-Palestinian Relations. It's happening Thursday, March 26th at UConn's Thomas J. Dodd Center. More information on our website, WNPR.org. Now, earlier this week, Benjamin Netanyahu came out saying that if reelected, he would never establish a Palestinian state. Then in an interview with NPR's Steve Inskeep, which we heard this morning on Morning Edition, he clarified the statement, said what he really meant was that under present circumstances, statehood is unachievable. Let's listen.
I said that the implementation of that vision is not relevant right now because of two things. First, the decision of the leadership of the Palestinian Authority last year to forge a pact with Hamas, which is a terrorist organization that works for our destruction.
Oh, the unity government that they tried to put together.
Well, they're still in it, and Hamas fired thousands of rockets at Israel's cities. And second, the dramatic changes that have occurred in the last few years in the region has brought the rise of militant Islam in any territory that is being vacated. By the way, that's true of Iraq and Syria with ISIS, as it's true of us in Gaza. We vacated and we didn't get peace. We got, an Iranian-backed terrorist enclave that is using the territory for launching pads against us. I think right now, in the immediate future, it doesn't hold until we correct these things.
And again, that's Benjamin Netanyahu speaking with NPR's Steve Inskeep. What's your reaction to some of what you heard?
I think Netanyahu probably knew all along that he could play these comments two ways to two different audiences, right? That when in the last days of the Israeli election, when he said there will never be a Palestinian state or along those lines, he knew that his listeners in the Israeli right would hear that as, well, there'll never be a Palestinian state. You're opposed to a Palestinian state, Mr. Prime Minister. But I think he also knew that he could then pivot and spin that argument after the election as, well, I meant under present circumstances. So I think, you know, it's a very brilliant sort of piece of political rhetoric in terms of how, depending on which audience is listening to you, they can hear it in a different way. So I don't think it's any surprise that he's now saying, well, I just meant under present circumstances.
Do you think that now that he has been reelected, that he has any stomach whatsoever to engage in the type of two-state solution that the United States has been now for decades trying to broker between these two parties?
No. I think one really instructive report was written by Alon Goldenberg, who was chief of staff to the special envoy during these latest Kerry negotiations on the U.S. staff. And he talks, among other things, about just the complete and utter lack of trust between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and that it's not that he thinks that the details are ironed out. It's not that he thinks that without those two, you could necessarily get a two-state solution between the two parties. But that with those two, he talks about how just the atmosphere and the mistrust is so deep that it's just almost impossible.
How much of that political piece has to do with mistrust that are on actually both sides of the fence, as it were, within the Palestinians there are many conflicts between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. Of course, as we've seen, this was an election that Benjamin Netanyahu, while winning substantially, clearly it was shown that there are a substantial number of people who do not feel that the right-wing Likud party is absolutely going to get to some sort of a peace process, which they desperately want. I guess I'm wondering, Jeremy, how much the divisions on both sides themselves play into all of this?
Yeah, I think that's very important. That's one of the issues that we're going to talk about next week in terms of fragmentation on both sides. It's quite striking, just to talk about the Israeli election for a second, that if you look at the results more sort of by blocks rather than by individual parties, that the left-wing bloc, the center bloc, and the right-wing bloc look pretty similar in terms of size to how they looked after the 2013 election. So I certainly take your point that there wasn't a huge shift in terms of who likes this approach that the Netanyahu government has taken and who doesn't like this approach. One of the things that I think is particularly interesting about the fragmentation on the Palestinian side is that for the Israelis, I think, like Prime Minister Netanyahu, what they really focus on, though, is Hamas. It's less interesting to them, I think, that it's fragmented than that they're concerned that Hamas is ascendant and they're concerned that any kind of Palestinian entity or state in the West Bank would ultimately turn into Hamasistan, as you'll often hear. So I think the fragmentation is important internally. It also, I think, shapes the rhetoric that each side uses towards the other.
And again, a more cynical way perhaps of looking at this is that as long as the specter of Hamas is there as a terrorist organization firing rockets into Israel, people in the position of Benjamin Netanyahu are always able to say, well, look, we cannot have peace with any group that has Hamas. And so for them, propping up the idea of Hamas allows them to never have to worry about a Palestinian state sitting next to Israel.
Fragmentation is very important. It's very difficult to send a clear, consistent message of conciliation or desire for talking or negotiation or diplomacy when there's violence and coercion going on from the other party. So,
but I guess what I'm saying is, to a certain extent, are there many people in Benjamin Netanyahu's party who would be happy with Hamas playing the role that it has played because it allows them to then have an attitude toward a two-state solution, toward Palestine, that is very much more hardline and doesn't get us closer to a peace deal? Essentially, if Hamas is there, we'll never have peace, and so therefore, we don't have to worry about having a Palestinian state.
I think that's right, but it's not happy from their perspective. It's a sanguine assessment of the sort of the what they see as the reality of Palestinian society. I think they're wrong. I think there is a desire on the part of both peoples to find a way to move forward, and that requires some reconciliation. The details of that, which are crucial, are not agreed upon, and that's partly why we're sort of stuck in this what seems like an endless cycle here.
We heard something else on NPR just in the last week when Morning Edition went to the region. We heard from Palestinian investor Bashar Masri, who's building an entirely new city in the West Bank. It's called Rawabi, and it was featured in a story. Here's a clip of Bashar Masri talking to host Steve Inskeep about the political implications of building this entirely new Palestinian city in the West Bank.
I'm not saying Rawabi is a political act. I'm saying that our daily life is a political act, whatever we do here. Anybody that builds in Palestine, anybody that creates a new company, a new factory, is a political act as well, of course. Of course, their goal may be to make money, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it is a political act because it creates jobs, it makes Palestinians stay on their land, and we are being pushed out.
Are you nation building?
100%. Absolutely.
I'm not sure how much you know about this particular development or if you heard the story, Jeremy, but it was fascinating to me just the context of it and listening to this Palestinian investor essentially making investments in settlements in a way for Palestinians to build anew.
One, I think, clear difference between the two sides is that Palestinians live with the occupation in a direct way every day. For some Israelis, it can become a little bit more distant. It can fade into the background a little bit, and which decreases the urgency to directly address it. And I think that for Palestinians, it's much more a part of their daily life and affects and shapes their daily life. I also think that the issue of settlement and putting down roots is so central here. Security is important, and we should talk about security as we have. But we also have to talk about the ideological and nationalist commitment to this territory on the part of both sides. So it's not that I don't think it's as if the only people who support Benjamin Netanyahu and the other parties that are likely to be in this next government with him are all basing their arguments on security. That's an argument. It's a powerful argument. But for many of them, it's about nationalism. It's about a biblical or a religious commitment to this land and this territory.
Well, and I guess in just the last couple of minutes that we have, though, there's also a sense, though, of beyond security and beyond sort of a biblical desire for this land. There's also just a desire, I think, of a lot of people on both sides just live well, to have a life that is not defined by rockets and security and biblical considerations. And that's something that I fear too often is lost in this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. But that I think that's what politics does sometimes, right? Politics turns into an argument about territory and power and coercion and fighting. And, you know, that sense of I just want to live my life gets lost in all that. And I think that what the politicians would say is, well, I want you to live your life, too. But I'm not going to cede my fundamental values. I'm not going to cede the survival of my people in order to do that.
Tell us in about a minute or so a little bit more about what you hope to talk about in the future of Israeli-Palestinian relations, because as we talk about it, and as we have in the past, it seems like so circular and so difficult to parse out. What are some things you hope to get to in your panel?
Well, I think one thing is just the structure of it. It's each of the three presenters is going to talk briefly so that we can really have a conversation where the audience is really a part of that conversation. We want to talk about the internal politics of both parties. So, for instance, Ora Cycli, a professor at Clark, will be talking about Hamas and Fatah and the fragmentation and the challenges that they face as they both fight against Israel and also try and govern particular parts semi-govern particular parts of Palestinian territory. We're going to talk about water management because that's something important to Professor Hodge and how water issues reflect in some ways the balance of power between Israelis and Palestinians. So the elections will certainly be a part of it. I think it's on everyone's mind. But I think, as you said, there's a lot of issues to discuss.
And do you feel at this moment, and I always ask you this, more hopeful, less hopeful for some sort of a peaceful conclusion in our near future?
In our near future, I'm less hopeful. This is not a government. What's likely to be the new Israeli government is not a government that sees a kind of two-state solution. I think that would play on the Palestinian side.
Jeremy Pressman will be moderating a panel discussion called "The Future of Israeli-Palestinian Relations," Thursday, March 26th at 7 p.m. at UConn's Thomas J. Dodd Center. Look for more information on our website, wnpr.org. Thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome.
When we come back from our break, The Atlantic's Graham Wood joins us. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. In an essay for the March issue of The Atlantic, contributing editor Graham Woods set out to answer some key questions about the Islamic State, questions about its beliefs and ideological roots. He called it what ISIS really wants. Today, Graham Wood joins us from a studio at Yale University to share what he learned while writing that essay. Also with us is Fariel Salem, who's an assistant professor of Islamic scriptures and law at Hartford Seminary, who's joined us to talk about issues regarding Islam in the past. Graham and Fariel, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Graham, first I'll start with you and go to some of the roots of your essay here. What is it that you see that's driving the so-called Islamic State or ISIS?
There are many things that drive it, but it has a very distinct ideology. And what my essay tried to do was to look at the statements of the group and the statements of some of its most doctrinaire supporters and find out what that ideology consists of. And it consists of a particular kind of apocalyptic, millenarian view of Islam, and particularly a type of Islam that tries to excommunicate really the vast majority of people who would call themselves Muslim. So it's a very exclusivist and apocalyptic view of the world, and that, I think, is what it ultimately believes.
How far back can we trace its roots?
In some ways, its roots only go back about 10 years. It was an offshoot of Al-Qaeda. Zarqawi, who we all remember from the Iraq occupation days, was in some ways its immediate precursor. But it broke from Al-Qaeda, first of all, in believing that the apocalypse was something that was happening very soon and that it had a part in, and also in being, in some ways, just simply more bloodthirsty. Al-Qaeda actually told Zarqawi and his successors to cut it out, not have so much bloodshed. And also, it was much more eager to attack Shia and other types of Muslims who didn't conform to its particular point of view. In that way, it's a pretty new movement. In some other ways, though, of course, it looks back and tries to project itself into a kind of view of what the earliest days of Islam were. In that sense, it attempts to look back 1,400 years.
And in a moment, I think we'll talk a bit about that history and the reality or unreality of that. Many people, Graham, have called ISIS non-Islamic, including President Barack Obama. What do you say to that?
Well, I understand when the president says that ISIS is not Islamic. He's the president. He doesn't speak as a theologian. But I think that he's also, in a very important way, simply factually wrong. Although ISIS is rejected by almost all Muslims, there's no doubt that it derives inspiration from Islamic texts and traditions and history. And when it tries to justify itself, again, Muslims can object, and they do, to its interpretations. But when it tries to justify itself, it does reach into this tradition. And in that sense, it is definitely Islamic.
Farial, I'm wondering first if you can comment a bit on Graham's definition and what you see maybe that you agree with, disagree with in there, so we can set a foundation for a bit of our conversation.
Sure. I think it's important to look at how we define Islamic. I think when Barack Obama is saying that the Islamic State is non-Islamic, and when the vast majority of Muslims say the Islamic State is non-Islamic, what they mean is that it doesn't adhere to the normative understanding of Islam as it has been understood for a millennium and a half. Now, certainly they understand a distortion of Islam, and they are inspired by a distorted view of Islam. But as the saying goes, even the devil can quote scripture, and this is an example of the devil's quoting scripture.
Mm. When, say, the president talks about ISIS being non-Islamic, as Graham rightly points out, this is in many ways a political statement. How is that viewed from your perspective, Farial, within the Muslim community itself, this idea of ISIS being Islamic or non-Islamic, or that, frankly, people from outside the faith could even pass judgment on that?
I believe that the president's statements are based on what the vast majority of Muslims also believe and would agree with, and that is that ISIS does not in any way represent the faith tradition of 1.5 billion Muslims. The number of individuals within ISIS has been estimated anywhere from 50,000 to 100,000. We have 1.5 billion Muslims across the world. And that would be something like less than 0.001% of the Muslim population. So to give these people the privilege of defining what is the Islamic tradition, what is normative practice, is really, in a way, not only inaccurate and does injustice to Islam as a vast civilization and tradition of a millennium and a half, but it also does PR for ISIS in many ways, inadvertently.
Mm. Graham, how does it indeed have the impact that it does, being as small a subset of the Muslim population of the entire world, this outlier in so many ways that has this outsized influence?
Well, for one thing, it's the most bloodthirsty of any sect of any religion that I can name right now. And the fact that it's very small, if it has a YouTube channel and it does the things that it does, then we're going to hear about it. Of course, there are many other sects within Islam that are equally small, and we call those Islamic without any question. It's just the fact that this one is particularly, it's incredibly abhorrent to Muslims and to everybody else. And so I completely understand the impulse of Muslims to try to distance themselves from it.
Farial, talk a bit about reconciling this, though, within the Muslim community. How even to talk about this, to not use language that might give power to this outlying horrific group, but also be true to yourselves, what you know about the tradition. Even having conversations about something like ISIS, I'm sure, is quite difficult within the Muslim community.
Not really. The Muslim community is, by and large, in consensus that these acts are not the normative Islamic practice. My focus is early Islamic thought, and my upcoming book focuses on a figure called Abdullah ibn al-Mubarak. And he has a famous quote called, "Isnad," or chain of transmissions, is from religion. Without chain of transmissions, whoever wished could say whatever he wished. And this is what chain of transmissions are, is the normative Sunni model of the way knowledge is passed and understood from generation to generation. So if you study classical Islamic texts and you look at classical Islamic literature, we have thousands and thousands of volumes of texts in Arabic just on what's known as the tabaqat tradition, or generational tradition. So even books of history, so if you look at Tariq Dimashq, the history of Damascus, if you look at the history of Isfahan, these books, interestingly, are not ordered chronologically, they're ordered generationally. And the idea is that the normative Islamic tradition, there is a normative scholastic tradition, and that is passed through a generation of scholars. So authority is derived from two things. First is by scholars who endorse a person's knowledge. So there is a circle of scholars who train and endorse a person. And then there's also the community that accepts or rejects that person. And usually what the community sees is the sincerity or the piety of the individual, in many ways similar to an ordainment process that you might see today in Protestant Christianity. So Islam certainly does have a normative scholastic tradition. And without looking at the normative tradition, people can say whatever they want. And this is something that has been discussed for centuries.
Just so that our listeners are clear, and so that I'm a bit more clear, though, what it seems to me that you're saying is, while anyone, as Graham is suggesting, including ISIS, can say, we are Muslim and we are acting on behalf of this faith, it is part of your scripture and part of your practice that would suggest that the larger body may be able to pass judgment on whether or not this outlying group indeed follows the tenets of Islam as you know it.
Oh, absolutely, because you can't derive religion just from text by itself. That's where you get extremism and things become dangerous in any faith tradition. If you have individuals who are poorly trained, who aren't trained within that tradition, who don't have the human interaction with the pious individuals within that tradition that engender within a person love, mercy, kindness, and the beautiful qualities of all of our faith traditions that are acquired through human interaction. So if people go straight to the internet or they go straight to text without contextualizing them, then it is dangerous in any tradition. And Christianity, Islam, Judaism has a rich tradition of guaranteeing or ensuring that individuals do not take religion and scripture into their own hands and take things out of context in a way that could be damaging to society. An example of that could be the Ku Klux Klan. So the argument that Mr. Wood is making here could be similar to saying that the Ku Klux Klan is very Christian. How can you say they're not Christian? Certainly they use scripture to justify their hateful actions. Scripture has been used for centuries to justify slavery, racism, and a variety of things. But is that the normative understanding of what those scriptures say? Does that adhere to the message of love and tolerance and peace that Christianity professes to?
Graham, would you have a response to that?
Yes, absolutely. So the question of whether ISIS is normatively Islamic, the question of whether they are the best type of Muslims, is not one that I take up, and it's one that I'm glad that Professor Salem and others take up within Islam. The question of whether the KKK was a Christian organization, I think there's no question that it was very Christian. Was it the best type of Christian? I think Christians would probably say that it was not. But of course, what Professor Salem is arguing against is direct engagement of texts outside of a historical context, outside of tradition, and that happens in many different types of religion. It happens in Christianity, happens in Judaism. And we don't say that Christians who have this kind of ahistorical relationship and direct relationship with text are not Christians or are unchristian. They may, again, be outside of traditions. They may be outside of the most common views of what Christianity can and should be. But are they Christian? Absolutely. And it's only, I think, in the case of Islam where we are sensitive about this for, I think, a lot of good political reasons, that we say that these groups are simply un-Islamic just because they're in this kind of fringe, death culty mode of interpreting their texts.
We're talking with Graham Wood, who's contributing editor at The Atlantic, whose piece, What ISIS Really Wants, got us thinking and talking about this. We brought into the conversation Farial Salem, who's an assistant professor of Islamic scriptures and law at Hartford Seminary, and this is where we live. I'm wondering, Graham, if you can take us back as we go into this historical piece which the professor is expert on, and maybe talk quickly about the history that you and others see ISIS as trying to claim as part of its story.
Yes, ISIS, it generally calls itself a Salafi group, and it believes that the sources of authority that it can look to are the Quran, the Hadith, and the early actions of the Prophet Muhammad and his earliest companions. So what they are looking to is their view of what these companions and the Prophet were doing in the early Islamic conquests. And what they think they're surrounded by right now, in the present day, ISIS believes it's surrounded by non-Muslims. And of course, it's surrounded by Turkey, it's surrounded by Syria, it's surrounded by Iraq. So by any normal standard, we would say that these are majority Muslim countries. So ISIS, on the other hand, believes that a whole variety of behaviors and views can exclude one from being Muslim. And so it believes that it, like the Prophet Muhammad and his companions in the early Islamic conquests, are surrounded by non-Muslims. And therefore, they think that there is enormous leeway that they have in fighting their way out of this and conquest through blood. So that's the view of the world that they are propagating. And I think Professor Salem can speak to how accurate that is.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can give us some historical context.
I'm glad you mentioned the Salafi movement. This is a modernist movement that believes in going back to the scripture directly and skipping 1,200, 1,300 years of history and scholastic tradition, and that they can understand what those scriptures say without the individuals who've preserved the understanding, the human qualities of the teaching in the way it was transferred. Now, the caliphate, I think there's a misunderstanding. Within Islamic history, the caliphate was not a theocracy in Sunni Islam. So the Sunni and the Shia differ in that for Shia, the imam or the leader is both the spiritual and the political leader. But for Sunnis, the caliph or the imam, the leader, is a political leader, and it was essential to have a differentiation between religion and politics. People of religion did not get too involved in politics so that they could preserve their own integrity and not be corrupted by it, and that people who are politicians would not get involved in religion so that it becomes something that is dictatorial or imposing upon people the way ISIS is doing today. Now, historically, the religious scholars were supported by religious endowments. These were funded by wealthy, sincere, pious Muslims, and their funding in that way was separate or independent of the state. And so the scholars were, in a way, like an electoral system, people who were recognized, loved for their sincerity and piety by the people, and the scholars then kept the caliphate or the politicians in check. So there was a checks and balances system. The way ISIS is currently conducting its state system really has no historical basis. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that in places where Wahhabism or Salafism is emphasized, Islamic history is not studied. Islamic civilization is not looked at very highly. It's regarded as though Muslims went astray for 1,300 years, and they have the authority to go back to the original scripture, assuming that they know whatever that was.
Aside from what we may or may not know about support for ISIS, the terrorist group, Farial, what do we know about support within the Muslim community, especially in those regions, of that very idea that you just put forward, of this idea that we have this sort of non-historical look that wipes out these 1,200 years of history and just goes back to scripture in this seemingly kind of primitive way?
The vast majority of Muslims do not agree or support this. The places that the Salafi movement has entered has created a lot of problems and chaos within that particular nation or country. One example would be Indonesia, for example, where the propaganda coming out of certain countries that profess a very rigid form of Islam is strong because of the wealth that they have. And there's a new movement within these countries of people who are sincere individuals but don't have the ability to really distinguish between a person who's just spewing scripture without context or somebody who is really trained within the tradition. And so a lot of simple people within certain regions will then take up these ideas. But again, those individuals are minorities, and they're not by any means the majority. The vast majority of individuals find the actions of ISIS abhorrent, and they do not in any way ascribe to them.
We're talking with Farial Salem, who's an assistant professor of Islamic scriptures and law at Hartford Seminary, and also Graham Wood, who's a contributing editor at The Atlantic, whose piece is What ISIS Really Wants. When we come back from break, we'll talk more about their presence in the Middle East and look at some of their efforts to expand outward, including into Africa. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, in her latest book, Burning Down the House, Nell Bernstein takes an in-depth look at the darker side of America's juvenile prisons. We'll listen to a conversation that I held with Nell at the Mark Twain House in Hartford. We'll take a look at the juvenile justice Alliance here in Connecticut and the governor's recent push for a Second Chance Society. I hope you can join us for that conversation. Today in the program, we're talking about the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS, or ISIL. Joining us is Graham Wood. He's a contributing editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from our studios at Yale University. Fariel Salem is an assistant professor of Islamic scriptures and law at Hartford Seminary. And we're trying to learn a bit about, as Graham puts in his piece, what ISIS really wants. Graham, many people have compared ISIS in some ways to Al-Qaeda. In your essay, you cite President Obama is calling ISIS Al-Qaeda's JV team. What's wrong with this?
I think there's some important distinctions to be made here. First of all, they certainly arose out of Al-Qaeda's movement, and they think that Osama bin Laden was a great guy and he had things right. But the ways that they've phrased their modes of authority, what they believe they want to do in the near term and long term, such as they think it exists, are somewhat different. So Al-Qaeda was really focused, its core group anyway, was focused on attacking Western targets. So 9/11 would be a good example, Madrid, London. Whereas ISIS is trying to create this caliphate in Mesopotamia, in the Levant. And what they want more than anything else is for Muslims to flock to that caliphate, to pledge it allegiance, and to create a state, which is something ISIS really never considered possible. It didn't think it would ever be able to have that kind of territory. The other distinctions, of course, as I've mentioned earlier, have been ISIS's focus on a near-term apocalyptic view of the world. They think the world will end in a particular way and that they'll be part of it. And they're also particularly focused on cleansing Islam of Muslims who disagree with them. And that includes many Sunnis who disagree, but also certainly all Shia, Sufis, many types of Muslim are completely unacceptable to them and they believe have to be killed in numbers that would certainly reach the hundreds of millions.
What does it say to you that the Islamic State recently accepted a pledge of allegiance from the extremist group Boko Haram in Nigeria?
I think it's a very interesting development. You know, ISIS believed that it would be expanding militarily on the edges of the territory that it has in Syria and Iraq. And I think it thought that it would be more successful in doing that. They've been beaten back, and now they've really changed their expansion strategy. So they've taken pledges of allegiance from places like Libya and now Boko Haram. So it's clear that they don't think that they can expand just by conquering radially from the Islamic State in Raqqa. And instead, they have to start taking on affiliates overseas.
While we don't know at this moment everything that we could perhaps know about an attack earlier this week in Tunisia on foreign tourists at a very popular museum, what we do know about that country in North Africa is that there's a very porous border between neighboring Libya and Tunisia, that indeed ISIS has in some ways inserted itself into Libya, and Graham, that many thousands perhaps of Tunisians have flocked to join the fight from ISIS. Do you see what happened this week in Tunisia as some sort of a new way of ISIS exerting itself in North Africa?
I think that's very possible. The grip that ISIS has in Libya in particular is extremely strong right now, and it's very depressing to see what's happened to Libya in the last couple of years. We don't actually know yet too much about Tunisia. We don't know what this attack consisted of, why it was done. There have been statements made, but I think we really have to look very carefully and specifically at the attacks, as we've been able to do with the Charlie Hebdo attacks, for example. And only by looking at the exact phrasings and claims of responsibility can we know what they really mean. That information just isn't in yet.
Fariel, I'm wondering if you can comment on that, because while, again, there in the Charlie Hebdo attacks, for instance, in France, there is some specific fact patterns we know in this attack that just happened the other day. We don't know very much, but it does seem clear as though young Muslims are both flocking from various places around the world to join a fight in Iraq and Syria, and indeed some of them are returning to their homelands and doing some things that are either drawing attention or indeed causing damage. How do you respond to that? What do you see in all of this, Fariel?
I see a population in which there are a lot of young people who have their own social grievances. They're not finding jobs. They're not respected in their societies. You have young people in France who may have been born and raised in France their entire lives. Their parents were in France their entire lives, and yet they're not considered French. So what you have, especially in Europe, is a generation of young men who are angry and unhappy with their social circumstances and their lack of opportunities. A lot of individuals see what they see in social media through Twitter and Facebook and the videos that are posted. They see this as an opportunity to do something significant with their lives because their own lives are so downtrodden and insignificant. Now, unfortunately, it should not be that way, but there was an article in the New York Times a week or two ago about two individuals who took the same path to extremism. One was a neo-Nazi, and the other one was a extremist Muslim, and that both were individuals who were treated poorly or beaten by, so the individual who went into the neo-Nazi track was beaten by individuals in high school who were immigrants and who he felt were putting him down. And the other individual, the Muslim young man, had a similar situation. So more than anything, these are individuals who have personal grievances that they find these movements to give them strength and opportunity in a way.
But, and Graham mentioned this before, I think one thing that we see that's different now than we've seen for centuries, really, when people who are in unfortunate circumstances look for something to lash out at. Here we have stories of young people from America, not necessarily from bad situations, watching YouTube videos or some other sort of online propaganda from a group like ISIS and deciding to join the fight seemingly for no other reason than it attracts them in some way. Did you see something different in there than what we've seen, again, for centuries of people wanting to join a fight against an oppressor that may or may not be right in front of them, but some oppressor? I think social media has changed the game.
Certainly, social media has changed the game where people can watch what is going on live from across the world. I think it's very important to point out that the number of people going from America is significantly less than the number of people interested in joining the fight from Europe. And again, that is because a majority of Muslims in the United States have different social circumstances where they are of a more comfortable, they have comfortable jobs, and they are not in the same type of situations that Muslims in Europe are.
Graham, do you see that this recruitment tool, the tools through social media that ISIS so far has used, only growing, or do you see some sort of a change perhaps in public opinion surrounding this over the course of time? Because indeed, as we see this brutality on video, we see what is happening at the hands of ISIS. I'm wondering if this is something that you believe will persist or grow.
I think the importance of social media is high. I think, first of all, because it allows them to terrify us more effectively and with higher production values, but also an interesting way because social media allows not exactly radicalization at home in front of your computer, but because there are all these YouTube channels, especially it allows young women in Europe to be recruited to ISIS. And that's the real change that I think we've seen with the rise of social media recruiting to global jihad, is that ISIS, as I say, is trying to create a state. It's not just trying to create a violent guerrilla movement. And so to do that, it has to have what I call in my article a demographically whole society. And so for the first time, they've been able to reach out to, if a conservative Muslim woman might be interested in these things, it would have been difficult for her to meet, for example, an Al-Qaeda recruiter on the street whom she'd never met before. But online, these kinds of interactions can happen much more easily. And I would just suggest that Professor Salem's point about social alienation and the kinds of feeling of being a misfit that a lot of European Muslims have, although I think that's very important in the recruitment to ISIS, it should be pointed out that the recruits tend to be more prosperous than the average European Muslim. They tend to be fairly privileged, actually. So it's definitely not a direct link between social alienation, rejection, poverty, certainly, and attraction to this movement.
In just the last few minutes that we have, I'd like to address a bit of the U.S. involvement in this region, Graham, and how the president's decisions to go after ISIS, ask for congressional approval to do so. Meanwhile, his Secretary of State saying that he's willing to negotiate with the Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad, that ISIS is indeed fighting in Syria. I guess I'm wondering how you believe U.S. involvement moving forward may change the game, hurt or help in the fight against this terror threat.
It's important to see that ISIS views the world in a particular way, and that is as a war between Islam and crusaders, which we can take as shorthand for America or the West. And I think it's very important that as we go forward, we avoid making that view of the world look credible. And I think already we've done a fairly good job of that by making sure that there hasn't been some kind of invasion as there was in Iraq, and making sure that the optics of this really center on Muslim enemies of the Islamic State. And Muslims have been very good about this, speaking with many voices in objection theologically to the Islamic State, but also militarily. We've got Muslim majority countries who are fighting against ISIS. And that's, I think, the way we need to look at things going forward. The other thing I would just counsel is some humility about what we could do militarily if we did have an invasion. Of course, ISIS couldn't have existed if it didn't have this enormous power vacuum that was created by the original Iraq invasion. So looking forward, we might take some lessons from our own failed history.
Something that perhaps we don't as a nation do quite enough. Farrell, I wonder your thoughts on that, on U.S. involvement and what it might mean to this situation.
In Syria in particular, I think it would be dangerous for the United States to be viewed as aligning with Bashar al-Assad. To be just and to have integrity in our interactions, not just at home but also abroad, I think is essential for establishing credibility of the United States abroad. People right now are deeply hurt and angry with what's going on in Syria. 6.5 million people have been internally displaced. 3 million people have been forced to become refugees. 200,000 people have been killed, and it's still continuing in Syria. The entire country has been destroyed. It's a humanitarian tragedy, and the world has stood aside and watched it. So if the United States is seen as compromising its integrity and its principles and ignoring this humanitarian tragedy to use talks with Bashar al-Assad to help its own interests or to serve its own interests, I think is just going to create a lot more angry people and a lot more people interested in joining ISIS just out of anger towards the United States. And I just want to add one more thing. Mr. Wood pointed out Muslim voices who are engaging the theological arguments of ISIS. And I think that's really important to mention and bring up. There was recently an open letter to Baghdadi that has been signed by pretty much every major Muslim organization in the United States. It's been signed by scholars from Canada, Egypt, Albania, Kosovo, Uzbekistan, Turkey, throughout the world. Pretty much every respected Muslim scholar leader has signed this letter. And this is theologically engaging the arguments that ISIS makes in their own language, within their own framework of reasoning. And I think if anybody's interested in looking at that further, you can just search open letter to Baghdadi. It's online. It's been translated into 5 different languages, and it talks about the normative Muslim position on things.
A last question I have to ask you, though. Do you believe that a reasonable argument, that a reasoned argument using scripture and history works in this case?
Not to convince ISIS to do otherwise, because they're really motivated by anger and zealotry more than anything else. However, this letter, more than anything else, prevents those who may be on the fringes or perhaps interested, or it's also informative for individuals who may be ignorant about the Islamic tradition and who want to learn more. So what does the normative Islamic position say about these issues that ISIS is bringing? And that's part of the reason also why we saw some sensitivity with the article, is that we live in a time of gross ignorance of Islam itself, who Muslims are, what Islam teaches, what is Islamic civilization. And with a title like, you know, ISIS is very Islamic, it's very easy to take that out of context and to interpret that as meaning this is what Islam is.
Farrell Salem is an assistant professor of Islamic scriptures and law at Hartford Seminary, our neighbor right down the street from us here at WNPR. Thank you so much. Great to see you once again.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Graham Wood, who's a contributing editor at The Atlantic. His piece, What ISIS Really Wants, got us thinking and talking about this. Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks to the folks at the Yale University Studios for hosting this conversation. I also want to say that Connecticut World Affairs Council is hosting an event as part of its Global Conversation Series called Countering Islamic Extremism. It'll take place at the Mark Twain House on March 26th at 6 p.m. More information on our website, WNPR.org. Our show produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Kyon Wolf. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Our intern is Kelsey Bissell. Continue the conversation at WNPR.org. John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live. We'll